This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 130. Today we speak with Daryl Hart about the Presbyterian and Reformed family trees. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and this is episode number 130. We've got a great program lined up for you today. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the program Jeffrey C. Waddington, who is teacher of the congregation at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. Thanks for coming on, Jeff. It's great to have you.
Happy to be here.
We also have Nick Batzig, who is a church planter with the PCA in Richmond Hill, Georgia, just outside of Savannah. Thanks for visiting us, Nick. It's great to have you back.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be on again.
Yes, and we also have our good friend Daryl G. Hart, who is visiting professor of history at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. And right now he's calling in from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Center City to be more precise. Thanks for joining us, Daryl. It's great to have you on.
Thanks, Camden.
We are going to be speaking today about a very interesting subject. I've had several requests from people for this very topic. We're going to be speaking about the Reformed and Presbyterian family trees. It's sometimes difficult when we get into Presbyterianism or the Reformed Church to try to understand all these different denominations, where they came from, what their history is, who joined with who split off from whom. And today we're going to try to dive into that with Daryl Hart, whom I can't think of anybody else that would be better to speak of this in this age. So thanks for joining us. But before we actually get started today, I have one big announcement. Just this morning, I found out that the Reformed Forum iPhone app is now available for download in the Apple App Store. It got through the approval process, which is not an easy thing, in the first try. So a big thanks goes out to my brother, Kelly Busey, who has spent many, many months working on this app, and I wanted to let everyone know that it's out there and available for those of you that have an iPod Touch, an iPhone, or even an iPad. You can download it. And I want to announce that first off right here. I actually haven't told any of you either that that's available.
That's right.
It's pretty slick. You can do all sorts of things. You can browse by all of our programs. We can get a list of every episode. You can search. You can add things to a playlist. You can stream live audio like we're doing right now if you had the iPhone app. You could listen to us in your car driving around and get to hear all of us talking about Reformed theology. And it's all available for free.
Hey, that's great. I'll try to talk my daughters into putting them on their iPods because then I'll be cool.
Yeah, exactly.
And pray that Verizon gets a contract with iPhone.
As of now, iPhone is still only on AT&T, but if you happen to have the device, check us out. Just search for Reformed Forum in the App Store. You'll be able to download it for free. Daryl, you've seen it, actually. You saw a beta version. You got to see your lovely picture on the iPhone.
Exactly. Yeah. Scary.
It is scary, but it's but it's fun. It's neat. And if you want to get Reformed theology on the go, now we're in the App Store, and you can get all of our programs for free. Right at your fingertips. Well, are there any other announcements? I guess it would be prudent for us to say that as of this recording, the PCA General Assembly is going on.
Yes.
And Nick, what are some of the big topics there that people are speaking about at GA?
Well, I think this year the big topic is the strategic plan. And what I know is that it was revised somewhat, more semantic issues, not calling safe places, but calling them places of civility, something like that. And so I think that's probably going to pass, and the ramifications for that, for the denomination, you know, we'll see how far reaching they're going to be. But I think that's going to actually come into our discussion with Daryl today.
Exactly.
What is Presbyterianism? Right. Why have denominations split and formed new denominations? Why are we denominated? So anyway, I'll just wait to listen to Daryl and then maybe bring that issue up.
Well, one interesting thing that came up with that strategic plan, if I'm correct, is some discussion about whether or not the PCA should leave NAPARC.
Yes, that's one of the
issues. Yeah, the language was sort of ambiguous. Some people said, well, that was just an example being given. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to know who wrote what and what their intent was, but it does seem like affiliations with our Reformed and Presbyterian and Reformed, Dutch Reformed and whatnot brethren, confessionally Reformed, are being sort of dismissed in favor of saying we need to be networked with, you know, the broader Calvinistic world, which is essentially, I think, what was the intent of that. So,
sure, regardless of what the intent of that language was, it's an interesting thing to think about in terms of how we denominate, as you say, and how we go about carrying out our call as a church, right, as a denomination that isn't by itself, one that is present among many others. So that's our subject today, understanding the history of all those connections and then understanding maybe a little bit about where it might be heading in the future.
Yeah, and I'd like to say, just as a final comment, Daryl, I would love for you to write something on Old Life about why are we denominated? Just philosophically, what is the philosophy of a denomination? Why? What's the difference between a denomination and a network? I know you kind of touched on this on a post you wrote about the Gospel Coalition, but right, a more historical and theological approach to what is a denomination, because there's just very little out there, and there's a whole lot out there about what networks are, and I think there's a real need for that.
Right. No, I've been thinking more generally about membership. I know when Guy Waters was on the show, he talked about, I think Camden brought me up in reference to some of the things you're talking about with Guy, and I just think we have a diminished understanding of what membership is overall, whether it's within a church or a communion or a political party or a state or a nation. So that's something I've been thinking a lot about, and generally speaking, we're much more in a network or coalition sort of age than we are with any kind of actual memberships that kind of restrict or limit our capacities to move around.
Do you find that that's sort of like a light version replacement of a denomination, where you could get into a network like, I don't know, I'll just give examples, like you said, the Gospel Coalition or the Alliance or the Acts 29 network or the Resurgence, I don't know, all these different networks, Mars Hill, that kind of stuff. What do you think the purpose of those associations are? Are they trying to get some of the benefit of denominations without all of the restrictions?
I think that's it. I mean, I also think it sort of makes you bigger than you would be in your denomination. It also means, for instance, you don't have to go to General Assembly and go through all the hoops that are associated with those meetings. And, you know, whether it's session, presbytery, or assembly, these are deliberative bodies, and they're business meetings, and they can be very boring. And it's more fun to go to a conference where you hear six really good speakers, and you get inspired, and you want to go out and conquer the world for Christ. But the sort of things that churches attend to at those business meetings are very important for the life and health of those congregations and presbyteries represented at these different layers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think that's going back to the strategic plan of the PCA. One of the things that the PCA is struggling with is trying to get congregations to support denominational programs and agencies to fully pay for those things. So it seems to me an odd tension currently within the PCA that on the one hand you have people like a Tim Keller who's part of the Gospel Coalition and somewhat untethered, by, therefore, in the Gospel Coalition by the PCA restrictions. On the other hand, the PCA wants, you know, people to fully pay for PCA programs and agencies. And so how do you keep money within the denomination and not let it spill out to other things? So, you know, the networks seemingly allow you to do more, but actually I think they end up getting less done because it's much more inspirational than it actually has to do with putting a missionary on a mission field, putting a new church plant somewhere in a new community. And those are sorts of seems to me the lifeblood of a real genuine communion or church.
When you also find a lot of the churches that are getting networked have congregational polity, And so, you know, joining together for a GA, a General Assembly, in which real church business will be done, and it's binding in a sense, could be binding. That's a little bit antithetical to much of the church governments or the church governmental structure that many of these network churches have.
And Daryl, I'd love to hear you talk about this today at some point, if not now, which raises the question, you know, why are we denominated? You sort of touched on the practical, pragmatic aspect of sending missionaries and seeing Christ's kingdom advanced in a denominational, unified sense. But there's also the aspect of doctrinal and moral accountability. And I know this kind of gets us into discussions about confessionalism and what it is, what it's not. And what strict subscription plays into this. So would you be willing to talk about some of that?
Yeah. I mean, part of the way denominations, it seems to me, arise here, and I wish I knew more about Europe, but it seems to me that Europe does not have denominations the way that America does, because America is a place where people from Europe went. I know there are other peoples here in North America, and yes, we've had difficulties accommodating Native Americans and African Americans, but by and large, it's a European settlement in the United States, and so that means that when the Dutch Calvinists came, they came with their churches. When the Scots or the Scotch-Irish came, they came with their churches. When the English Puritans came, so then you have these different churches being planted, in effect, in America. And that's denominationalism is a way to kind of negotiate all these different churches that are here. And, I mean, denominationalism is really a sociological category that that scholars who study this kind of church plurality in the United States have used to try to make sense of it. But because we don't have an established church system, so that you don't have necessarily here a state church or dissenting churches the way you do in European settings. What we have is a kind of a smorgasbord of denominations.
Exactly.
And they all have different histories. In many respects, those histories are bound up with a kind of ethnicity. So in the same way that the politics of identity or multiculturalism are playing out in America, have been playing out for the last 25 years, denominationalism is a kind of earlier expression of a kind of multiculturalism, but it's a way that these churches actually tried to work out agreements or get along with each other and not devour each other. And eventually that denominationalism moves into a kind of ecumenism in the late 19th and early 20th century, where these churches begin to join federations or unions. So the Federal Council of Churches, formed in 1908, becomes one of the early expressions of a kind of pan-denominationalism. There's an effort in 1920 for an organic union of these churches to become one united Protestant Church of America, the way you have the United Church of Canada, founded in 1925, roughly the same time, same impulse. And ongoing within the mainline churches is still the COCU, which is the Something on Church Union, still trying to get a more organic connection among the churches. But anyway, you have it's a really fascinating process by which these churches from the old world come to the new world and then kind of find themselves with other Protestants of different stripes and try to work out some kind of arrangements to live together and even eventually cooperate.
So speaking of that, then all the different churches coming from different places and finding themselves in America or Canada, what would you describe as the difference between Presbyterian and Reformed in an historical sense, or is there no difference?
Well, it basically has to do with the difference between different sides of the English Channel. So on the European side, the continent, the churches that come from Zurich and Geneva are largely called Reformed. And in England, the United Kingdom, those churches gain the title Presbyterian, even though most of the leading reformers in England and Scotland had done service, or were refugees on the continent during the 16th century. Still, for whatever reason, historically, we call the Reformed churches in the English speaking world, we call them Presbyterian, and in the continent, continental Europe, we call them Reformed. And there are, of course, differences between Presbyterian and Reformed churches as they evolved. Specifically, if you want to look at the difference between, say, Presbyterian and Reformed church polity, between, say, the Scottish-American Presbyterian developments and the Dutch Calvinist or that Reformed world, there's more of a congregational kind of polity among the Reformed churches, so that the minister, for instance, in a Reformed church, Dutch Reformed church, is a member of the congregation in a way that the ministers in Presbyterian churches are members of presbyteries. And so Presbyterians in America talk about a regional church, and on Dutch Calvinists will sometimes complain that doesn't make any sense. How can you be a member of that kind of member of a Presbyterian called Presbyterian Church? So there are interesting wrinkles on the polity level between those two, but generally speaking, those Presbyterian Reformed are synonymous, and one having to do with the Anglo-American world, the other having to do with the European.
Now, would that be some of the reason behind Cornelius Van Til wanting to become a member at Calvary, at the church where his wife was a member, even though he was an ordained minister, because he was Dutch?
I think that would be part of it, yeah. Although I wonder if, you know, Van Til, being a thoughtful guy, might have had a lot of other reasons for that.
Sure.
But I wonder if that's the case, yeah.
Yeah, now I believe in the OPC, ministers have the option, and by default they become members of the regional church, but I think you can opt to become a member of the local church, which might have been a result of Van Til's desires. And
I'm not sure the pastor in who's installed.
Yeah, it might only be an option like somebody like Van Til.
I think it's only for those who are still members of Presbytery, not actively serving in a ministerial capacity. And Ken, as you well know, our congregation, Calvary Glenside, has a variety of ministers who are serving denominational capacity, and so they're members. They may be members of the congregation if they want, which can make congregational meetings awfully interesting. If you have ministers kind of expecting congregational meetings to conform to the way Presbytery operates, but anyway.
God forbid.
So, Daryl, can you give our listeners a brief summary of Presbyterianism as it came to the States from Scotland and England especially?
Yeah, well, I can try. It's in my understanding, it's really fascinating that, especially if you ever want to compare it to Canada, although it gets really, really soupy, but when you look at the way Presbyterianism went to Canada, and the reason why Canada is interesting is because of a place like Nova Scotia, New Scotland. So Canada was in some sense regarded as an outpost for Scottish developments, and so the different branches of Presbyterianism that emerged in the 17th and 18th centuries in Scotland have direct transplants in Canada, and you even eventually have the Free Church that arises in 1843 in Scotland, also a division in Canadian Presbyterianism mirroring that division in Scotland. Whereas in the United States, it's the mainline church, the church that starts in 1706 with the First Presbytery here in Philadelphia, really grows up autonomously. I mean, the people come from Scotland or Northern Ireland, and the ministers, many of them, were ordained in the Old World. But it's not a daughter church of either Scotland or Northern Ireland. It's a group of guys who get together and say, you know, we need to form a Presbyterian church, and they do so. Now, also complicating things in the United States is the Covenanter tradition, which is now still represented by the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America, and then the Seceder tradition, which is the associate reform represented in the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church. Now, those are churches that do come directly from Scotland and are, in some senses, were daughter churches of those Scottish communions. But the main American body, the PCUSA and now the OPC and the PCA, all come from a kind of original New World Presbyterianism that doesn't have a direct mother church in the old world.
Hmm. Interesting. What were some of the big divides or cause of splits maybe in the 18th century? What were the two big things that caused a rupture in the Presbyterian Church, and why did those come about?
Well, there was the split of 1741, the old side, new side controversy, which took place, as did the new school, old school controversy of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to get those confused when you have two new and olds going on, but there's an old side, old school, new side, new school.
Right.
You got to get your centuries right. But both took place in the context of revival. Now, what's hard sometimes for probably many of your listeners to keep in mind is that the revivalists of the 18th century were Calvinistic. So they were all five-point Calvinists, people like Edwards and even Whitfield. But they were not always the best on Presbyterian polity, and sometimes also their understanding of the work of the Spirit ran at odds with creedalism or subscription. And so the old side, they could have been proto-liberals and they could have been drunkards, which is always the characterization of them, but there were a lot of good guys who were old-siders, and they were insisting upon subscription. They were insisting upon proper church polity and going along with the rules of presbyteries and synod. And they were also a little worried about this institution called Log College that was founded by the tenants, which was producing all these revivalistic pastors who were not always showing the most respect for Presbyterian order. So that was the major cause of that controversy. And So that lasted until they remained separate until 1758. But issues of creedalism or subscription, issues of polity, and issues of theological education were bound up in that split in the 18th century.
And then what happened in 1810, another group broke off, the Cumberland Presbyterian Church.
Right.
What was their deal?
Well, they were influenced a lot by the kind of primitivism associated with the Stones and the Campbellites, the people that would eventually go into the Church of Christ or the Disciples of Christ, which was a kind of hybrid of Enlightenment rationality and going back to Scripture alone. And so they didn't want any man-made creeds, and they thought, the Cumberlands thought that the Westminster Confession had a lot of man-made stuff in it. They were still willing to live with parts of it, but the Cumberland Presbyterians basically gutted the federal theology that was part of the Westminster Standards. So chapters 3 through 7 roughly come out of the Westminster Confession, and it's a form of Presbyterianism that's accommodating the new kind of revivalism, the anti-Calvinistic revivalism of the Second Great Awakening in the 19th century.
Mm. And then later in the 1830s, there was another big split, perhaps more well-known split, between the old school and the new school. How did that whole disagreement between the two sides of the church end up falling down along the political sides?
The old school, new school split is in 1837. And it's in some ways sectional, but it includes, the New Englanders and the upper Midwest churches, where a lot of Congregationalists were, split, are largely New School, and the Old School is largely in Philadelphia, southern New Jersey, and in the South. And so there is a kind of regional dimension to it, but it's not in the same way that the regional conflict that would erupt with the Civil War. And the major issues there go back to a plan of union in 1801 between the Presbyterians and Congregationalists as a way to order the planting of churches in the Northwest Territory, places like Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Ohio. Both of those churches were going to cooperate in planting churches, and this gave some rules for what happens if there's a conflict in the church, et cetera. But in the 1830s, because of the influence of Nathaniel Taylor's New Haven theology, which is, again, very much taking issue with the federal theology of the Westminster Standard.
Right.
And it's basically Finney's theology. Old schoolers are very much concerned about, alarmed by that kind of the discrepancies with Calvinism, and they're also alarmed by the abuse of Presbyterian polity going back to the Plan of Union. So they kind of take stock of that plan, and they say, no, we don't want it. So the old school basically kicks out the new school, and those two sides remain apart until the 50s and 60s, when then the new school actually divides between North and South, and in 1861, the old school divides between North and South. So the Civil War issues, and especially slavery, are at work in dividing those communions into Northern and Southern branches. So by 1861, mm-hmm. you actually have four different Presbyterian churches, old school North, old school South,
yeah.
new school North, new school South.
Right.
And it's really quite messy.
And then they decide, they eventually decide to fall down along the line. So the two sides
right.
in the North, for better or for worse, if you read Seeking a Better Country, you'll hear Daryl and John Meether's argument that it's for worse. You end up with these groups, both old school and new school in the North, coming down and coming together into a union because they're in the North. And for political reasons or for other reasons, they decide to unify and ended up causing some problems because they decided to come together, not necessarily based on doctrinal considerations, but based on other considerations.
The politics of union were a major factor. I mean, the other thing to keep in mind is that the new school was by no means overwhelmingly Finneyite or Taylorite. There were good new schoolers, but the problem for the old school was that the new school would not condemn the Taylor or Finney views. So they would not exclude those views. So, I mean, this is a similar tension that's going on within our circles. It's not just a question of whether you affirm the right things, but in your affirmation, are you also willing to make denials? So there are plenty in there. I mean, this is something that still bedevils our own churches. I mean, so people can say there are plenty of good people in the PCA, plenty of good people in the OPC, but the question also becomes whether those good people are willing to exclude erroneous views or not. So that's really what was still at issue even up until 1869. Charles Hodge is one of the lone opponents of reunion, and he still is unwilling to make peace with the new school because he still says the new school never repudiated the views of Albert Barnes, who was one of the big proponents of the kind of Finneyite Taylor theology mm-hmm. within the Presbyterian Church.
So if we fast forward into the modernist fundamentalist controversy, what major Presbyterian bodies are existing and what are some of the dynamics there?
Well, by 1920s, you have the Northern Church, which is the PCUSA, and you have the Southern Church, the PCUS, they're leaving off the A. And so the fundamentalist controversy really happens in the North, and it's really, again, along sectional lines. If you look at the 18th century controversies, the 19th century controversies, and then the 20th century, it's usually New York against Philadelphia. Philadelphia is the conservative wing of the church. New York is the liberal or progressive wing of the church. And so that's going on in the 1920s as well. And the Presbytery of New York and the Synod of New York are the home of the most liberal voices in the church. And Philadelphia is the home of the most conservative voices of the church, with the Presbytery of New Brunswick, where the faculty of Princeton were members usually, being in this kind of weird middle ground, but New Brunswick is actually closer to New York and actually more oriented to New York in some ways. So that's why eventually the Presbytery of New Brunswick will bring Machen to trial in 1935 and suspend him from the ministry and from membership in the church. So again, the issues in some ways are not are worse in the 1920s than say the ones of the 18th century, the 19th century, although you can see a definite progression of where I would argue, where the new side, new school trajectory can lead. It can lead to a kind of liberalism, again, because it fails to exclude error from the church. It eventually becomes very difficult to exclude even the big errors. I mean, if you don't exclude the little errors, how are you going to exclude the big ones?
I was just going to ask for our listeners' own benefit. Would it be fair to say then that all the issues in the history of the Presbyterian Church in America, all the splits, and everything that we've talked about thus far leading up to Machen and the old Presbyterian denomination and even the PCA forming out of it in 73, that all of that centered on confessional subscription, or would that be reductionistic?
No, I mean, I think that is always an issue. There are other ones at work as well, but that is the conservatives. At least that's always a fallback position for the conservatives, that we are bound by these standards, and they're part of the constitution of the church, and we need to require that and expect that from officers in the church. And so I think that's fair, yeah.
And even with Machen, that was the issue, right, with the professors at Princeton and the liberals in the old Presbyterian denomination saying, basically, well, we do hold to the tenets of the standards, Westminster standards, but, you know, as a theory generally, not as...
Right, that's what the Auburn Affirmation especially said. I mean, you can see, again, forerunners of that in the kind of... Charles Finney, I don't know if people realize this, but Charles Finney was ordained in the Presbyterian Church.
And now it's a black mark on our...
yeah.
But, I mean, so... And he actually somehow subscribed to Westminster Standards.
Well, he admitted that he had never read them.
Right.
When he was queried on that, he had admitted that he never... I forget it was long after, when he had gone congregational, someone said, well, didn't you subscribe to the Westminster Standards? And he said, yes, but I never read them.
Right. Well,
that was
is that ex animal
area of upstate New York.
And the other interesting wrinkle there is the man who tutored Finney in the faith after his conversion, as I understand it, was a Presbyterian minister who was a graduate of Princeton Seminary. So you might expect that the Princeton guys would be more diligent in explaining Calvinism and the creed to Finney, but that didn't seem to work. So anyway, if Finney can somehow subscribe the standards, whatever the ordination requirements were in upstate New York, you can see how other much more liberal views could come in by the 1920s, which is what, Nick, as you were saying, the Auburn Affirmation basically made this distinction between doctrines and theories, and that you could hold to the virgin birth, but there are various theories for explaining the virgin birth. And they were arguing, the liberals were arguing for confessional latitude in the Presbyterian Church for a variety of theories for understanding the doctrine of the virgin birth. And so that was a major issue in the battles of the 1920s and 30s.
Mm. Now, what happened then in 1936 to start off what we might consider the more contemporary versions of Presbyterianism that exists
right.
today?
Well, Machen was brought to trial in 1935 for starting the Independent Board for Presbyterian Foreign Missions, and his trial was appealed to the General Assembly of 1936. That assembly met in Syracuse, New York, a good Finney stomping ground, upheld the verdict, and so when Machen was then suspended from the ministry, he and about 5,000 other people left to form the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, not originally called the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Originally, it was actually called the PCA, the Presbyterian Church in America. Wait, of America.
Of America, yeah.
And then the PCUSA sued the OPC because they thought its name was too close to theirs, and the OPC would attract funds away from the PCUSA. So the court in Pennsylvania upheld the suit against the OPC, and one of the signatures on that suit was J. Howard Pugh, who was serving in one of the board capacities in the PCUSA at the time, which is quite ironic because Pugh was a great supporter even of Westminster Seminary and of conservative evangelical and Presbyterian causes, starting the layman within the PCUSA, but at that point, he was involved in the church in such a way that his name wound up on the suit against the OPC. So the OPC begins in 1936. There's a split in 37 between the Orthodox Presbyterians and the Bible Presbyterians. Carl McIntyre and J. Oliver Buswell lead a group out of the OPC over a variety of issues. The chief among them was prohibition or temperance, and whether the OPC would support a position of requiring abstinence from alcoholic beverages. The OPC came down on the side of Christian liberty, supposedly, and the Bible Presbyterians walked. And then in the PCA, the PCA that we now know as the PCA starts in 1972, within the Southern Church, the PCUS, there's a similar kind of crisis over liberalism, and so conservatives leave the PCUS in 1972. What's really interesting to me about this is that it looks like the Southern Presbyterianism is always about 40 years behind Northern Presbyterianism. So,
yeah, exactly.
Right.
The PCUSA, the Northern Church, revises the Confession of Faith in 1903, and that's when you have two chapters added about the love of God and the Holy Spirit that soften the hard edges of Calvinism, at least supposedly. And then 1942, the Southern Church makes a similar revision, same chapter, same language, numbered differently, but the same revision. So there's about a 40-year gap. And there's also about a 40-year gap between the founding of the OPC and the founding of the PCA. So it's kind of interesting just to see that time lag and the way that the North may be evolving at a certain rate of speed differently from the South.
Mm. Well, I just wanted at this point to get Daryl to help us think through why the Southern Presbyterians didn't go with the Northern Church. That largely had to do with boards and committees, beside the fact that the men that are now, that currently are in the PCA, that founded the PCA, a lot of them wanted to stay in and hope for revival in the PCUS. But it largely centers on a difference of philosophy, doesn't it, with regard to boards versus committees and the old, isn't that the Thornwell Hodge? Didn't they have a debate about that? I know.
Right, they did. Although the OPC is on the Thornwell side of it.
I know you're more Southern Presbyterian philosophically now, what Southern
right.
Presbyterianism was.
Well, even early on we were. I mean, it's interesting that the OPC, which has really never thought of itself in terms of Southern Presbyterianism, despite Machen's own background in the Southern Church. I mean, he worked for most of his career in the Northern Church, so it's natural for the OPC to think more in terms of Northern categories. But the fact that we don't have boards but committees for the various agencies of the church suggests that Thornwell won within the OPC. So the short answer to your question, Nick, is I don't know, and the guy to ask about this is Sean Lucas, who's writing a history of the conservatives in the Southern Church and the formation of the PCA. But I do think that the regional differences were very strong going back to the Civil War. I mean,
right.
So strong that it took until 1983, some 125 years almost later, for even the mainline churches to reunite.
Right.
So if it was difficult for the mainliners, who had much fewer scruples about merging, if it took that long for them to merge, it's conceivable to think that both. I mean, people will often complain, why didn't the OPC go into the PCUS in 1936, or the conservatives in the Northern Church, why didn't they go into the Southern Church? Well, the Northerners weren't thinking in terms of the Southern Church. I mean, they just kind of lived with these compartments of a Southern and a Northern Presbyterianism.
Right.
And I think the same thing was going on with the Southerners in the PCA. They were thinking in terms of Southernness, regionalism. And so the OPC was up there, we're going to do something down here. And the OPC didn't really have many churches in the South, so it made more sense for the PCA to be separate. So Anyway, that regional mindset was very much there for on both the liberal and conservative sides of
Daryl,
Presbyterianism. Yes.
Yeah, the two questions related to this. One is, can you explain to us what the difference is between a committee and a board to help us get at that Thornwell-Hodge debate?
The boards, as I understand it, were had many people on it, some of whom were not even officers in the church. I mean, wealthy givers to various causes could be appointed to as board members, just in the same way that we will have board members at a seminary or a college. People who aren't, you know, they're not on the faculty, they're not part of the administration. These are wealthy donors to the college, and they're part of the board. So that's the kind of structure that you had for agencies in the church, particularly, say, the Board of Foreign Missions. Thornwell's argument was that the work of gospel proclamation and evangelism and sacraments and things like that needs to be overseen in a Presbyterian system by one of the judicatories of the church, Session, Presbytery, or General Assembly. And the committee structure was a much better way. A committee was a part of the whole, so a committee was a part of the General Assembly, appointed by the General Assembly. These were all officers in the church. The committee members would then oversee this work of foreign missions, not having non-ordained people on the board, not having people there based on their wealth, not having an independent existence apart from the General Assembly. So that's really what that was really the nub of Thornwell's concern. And Hodge didn't always have the best Presbyterian polity, so he was trying, I think, to fudge it. I don't know Hodge's position as well, but anyway, that's the nature of
that. Well, that's interesting. That's a perennial problem, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, that temptation to get away from church proper ecclesiastical structure. I'm tempted to make a comment about the strategic plan in the PCA. I'll leave that alone.
You don't have to go there, but it does go to this, what we talked about earlier, denominations versus networks. The networks are not overseen by the church, and the denominations are overseen. So, yeah.
Right. The other question had to do with the regionalness of the two churches, the OPC and the PCA. While the history is for the OPC in the north and the history of the PCAs in the south, it seems to be no longer the case that we are geographically limited. How does that play into our current relationship, or does it? Sorry about that.
It plays in very complicated ways. I mean, we have, you know, NAPARC, the North American Presbyterian
Comedy Agreements and
Churches. We have a comedy agreement, right? And I don't know that either communion is playing by those rules. I think my own perception is that the PCA may not abide by them more than the OPC. But I think there have been times when the OPC has also. I mean, I know, for instance, there is an OP church plant, a new work in St. Louis, and there are 22 PCA churches out there. Why do you need an Orthodox Presbyterian church? So you could argue on both sides of the case that neither church is doing that. The comedy agreement is an expression of, now that these churches are no longer regional, they are in some ways competing with each other for members and converts, et cetera, in various areas. But it also suggests the reason why you would have a PCA church when there's an OP church nearby. For instance, I know the people in Portland, Oregon. Good work out there, First Orthodox Presbyterian Church. I spoke at their family Bible camp, had a great time with the folks out there. And within a couple miles of the church came a church plant 2 or 3 years ago, led by two former students, guys whom I really like, and Southerners to boot. And yet, you know, I'm sort of wondering, I hope they don't take away members from the OP work. In some ways, the churches, both denominations, have increasingly different philosophies of ministry. And I think that's part of what is now in competition.
Daryl, from a sociological perspective, and I'm probably going to get myself in trouble here, but would you say that and obviously this is a generality, but the PCA is made up of people that are old school, new side, and a mixture of all of those ideologies. And the OPC would be made up more of sort of old school, and then maybe some with some new school methodologies.
Right.
Is that a fair assessment?
That I think
PCA
that's very fair.
Or
I mean,
of a hodgepodge of all those historical movements?
What we need to keep in mind are a couple of things. One, the PCA is no longer only the Southerners that left the Southern Church in 1972. Mm-hmm. The PCA also merged with or received and joined with the RPCES.
Yeah.
The Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod was largely a group of Bible Presbyterians that finally got fed up with Carl McIntyre in the 1950s and went their separate way. But their roots are Bible Presbyterian, and they then joined with an older Covenanter group that was pro-revival. So the RPC General Synod, GS, I guess it was, and that's how they got the name RPCES. When that group came in, you had a large, you know, Northern and new school sorts of elements coming into the PCA, which was by no means old school necessarily in its orientation, but there was clearly an old school contingent within the original Southern PCA.
Right.
And then one other factor here is that there was a kind of new schoolish development within the OPC's history, the New Life movement led by Jack Miller.
Right.
And that was a dominant motif in the OPC in the 1970s, for instance. And eventually, the New Lifers left the OPC. Most of them left to join the PCA. So you have yet another group, an infusion into the PCA, and that's actually where Keller comes from. I mean, that kind of wing of New Life Presbyterianism. He was, I think, very associated with Jack Miller when Keller taught it at Westminster, Philadelphia, and went to the church in Glenside. So that's another whole interesting wrinkle on the current configuration of the PCA. So the OPC has kind of emerged as more old school as it's developed and also lost various members along the way.
And I guess what a lot of people don't understand is that people who would be critical of the effects of bringing in the RPCES and the effects of bringing in new school methodology and or new side, even to some extent, and probably that would be challenged by some. But we're not saying we don't want to bring people in to the PCA who, you know, may have different nuances here or there. But we allowed those denominations to keep their heritage, their history, and so we essentially broadened our standards.
Right.
Without actually going in and doing the work of broadening and revising our confessional standards, right?
Right. And here, there's a really fascinating article that R.B. Kuiper, not the same Kuiper as Abraham Kuiper,
right.
It's spelled differently as well. And I guess the Dutch actually pronounce his name Cooper. R.B. Kuiper, for many years, taught at Westminster Seminary, but he also was taught at Calvin College and Calvin Seminary. I mean, so he straddled both sides of the Reformed Presbyterian world here in North America, or in the United States. And anyway, anniversary of the OPC, 1946, writes an article called What's Right with the OPC? And he talks about the OPC is narrow in the proper sense of the word, and it's cosmopolitan or broad in the proper sense of the word. And you can disagree with his take on this, but one of the things that I think sometimes gets lost when we talk about receiving people into Presbyterian churches and including people within our fellowship is that, and this goes back to the PCA's participation and membership within NAPARC and whether they want to be associated with these seemingly narrowly reformed churches that are in NAPARC, or if they want to be more broadly Calvinistic. But those narrowly reformed churches in NAPARC, the smaller ones, are also holding on to the fuller expressions or the broader expressions of reformed Christianity that are in their confessions. And those churches are oftentimes in fraternal relations with churches around the world, Reformed churches in other parts of the world, in a way that oftentimes the more new schoolish Presbyterianism of the United States has been overtly American and less interested in an international Calvinism. So it wants an American Calvinism and not an international Calvinism, and this American Calvinism will go around the world and plant American Calvinists other places. But instead of respecting sort of the churches, the indigenous churches, or the European traditions that may be elsewhere. So there, the broad and narrow distinctions can go both ways. Now, if it comes down to just numbers, then the broad version has more numbers in it, and so it looks broader. But if it comes down to creedal expressions, the narrow or the smaller numbers have a broader understanding of the Reformed faith, a fuller understanding, a more maximal as opposed to a minimal understanding of what God has revealed in Scripture.
Now, I mean, the challenge that most are going to say is that, but they're small, they're not reaching people. And that, I know you hear that, it's all over the blogosphere.
Right.
And so I think your point is intriguing that they have connections. The smaller Reformed denominations often do have more of a worldwide connection with other churches and ministry with other like-minded churches and are less Americanized in that sense. But do you think, and I'm just giving you a chance here to just get your thoughts out on this, do you think we have that the smaller Reformed denominations can learn from the more, I'm going to use the word missional.
Right.
Expecting our listeners to know what that means to some extent. Do you think we can learn from that as, you know, Reformed, confessionally Reformed, smaller denominations?
I mean, I have to say yes, because I'm willing to listen, but I'm going to listen to the missional folks with my Presbyterian ears on. And
right.
and I am limited by what I can hear. I know that sounds narrow-minded, but that's the nature of having a confession and having a polity. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that old-school Presbyterianism stood for was a jure divino Presbyterianism. This is a Presbyterian rule by God, by divine right, in effect.
Right. Right.
And that God has revealed Presbyterian polity, Presbyterian order, as the way to run the church. It's not just an option or a preference, but it's the real deal. And so,
right.
You know, and that involved with that, of course, is Reformed worship or Presbyterian worship and the regular principle. So I'm willing to think about ways that we can try to reach new converts for Christ. I mean, that has to be the case. But we have to do it in a Presbyterian way, and that's always the tension.
Right.
Is that the Presbyterian way appears to be less effective. But here's the upside of the Presbyterian way. It sticks with the convert for the long haul. So that right. The Presbyterian way is not simply interested in converts. It's also interested in shepherding a convert over the course of his or her entire life. And, you know, when you get to the end of a life, as I recently have with two deceased parents, I mean, that's in some ways when the real test comes. It's not whether that person decides in their 20s to go to your church and to join in the fellowship and the up-tempo worship. Is that person, where is that person going to be when they're on their deathbed? Not to bring,
right.
You know, that kind of decisive question there, but, you know, so will they still be, you know, really looking to their Lord over the course of a lifetime? And that's also what the Presbyterian polity, it seems to me, or the Reformed Christianity is interested in. It's not simply the new converts, but it's also the old timers. We need to
right.
care for them as well.
Right. That's excellent.
So to try to wind things up, what do you see as a way for moving forward in terms of unity within the Christian communion in general? And how can churches that have their specifics, that have their doctrinal standards, that have their own denominations, how can we still proceed for the sake of the kingdom of God with other communions that don't share our particulars in church polity or
right.
in particular doctrinal formulations?
Well, on the one hand, I would offer up Bob Godfrey's modest proposal for a kind of a federated church, You know, so I guess you've got to be careful here, since the Federal Council of Churches may have tried this. But a federated church of Reformed communions, so those members that are in NAPARC, for instance, would actually become part of a federated church that would meet maybe every 4 years with a you know, the big synod.
So we would have some sort of trophy up for grabs every 4 years, just like
the
World Cup.
Well, I could get into that, but... But each church would still retain oversight over its own matters.
Mm-hmm.
But then they would participate in a larger body, almost like a United Nations of Reformed churches.
Do you have something like this with the National Council of Churches, or these just turn into political action committees, or what?
Well,
I mean, has this sort of thing been tried already?
The URC is more of a federation, right?
Right, yeah. Right. But this, I mean, so... This kind of model, you would have, you know, in the same way that you had delegates, or you know, so many delegates come to General Assembly within the OPC or the PCA. You know, they have all these rules for how you get represented there. You'd have similar rules for this federated church. But the difference would be that this would actually do church business, as opposed to the National Council and the Federal Council, which were, I think, more engaged with kind of social activism or whatever. I don't know what that agenda would look like, but, you know, you could see cooperation in terms of publications and education and missions and church planning, for instance. So that's one thing that could be tried, so that there would be an effort to realize an institutional unity while still retaining the identity of each of the different denominations. So rather than having a strict merger, you have some kind of federated structure. The other thing I'd say in going forward is I would like to see us hold ecumenical conferences or councils or something where Presbyterians would meet with Baptists and Lutherans. And you know, I don't know how you extend or make up the invitation list, but where we'd actually talk about, okay, so where do we stand? Where are we different? Why are we different? And at least sort of, you know, we sort of live with those differences from the 17th century, but we don't really talk about them much anymore. We just kind of talk among each other about what the differences are. But I would like to actually see some Lutherans and Presbyterians and Baptists get together, for instance, and just say, what are our differences? What do we need to work on? Is there any way that you guys have budged in 300 years or not? And see what happens.
You know, Daryl, that's really interesting, because I was talking to a prof from Concordia Seminary in Austin the other day. And a great guy, really solid brother in the Lord. And he was telling me that there's been sort of that there's been almost a revival in Lutheranism with regard to the third use of the law, which has been, as you know, a heated issue,
right?
Even in our discussions. And he said a lot of Missouri Synod guys are starting to say, wait a minute, we need to reconsider how the law of God is useful to the believer, not just its role in justification. So I thought that was kind of interesting that, like,
right,
you're saying, we're not even discussing with these people what's going on. We're just sort of tagging everything. And I think that's
an intriguing
point.
And where we are
point.
Discussing it too often is in a network. And I would rather actually have our real churches call,
right,
you know, send appoint people. I mean, most of our churches already have ecumenical committees. So send people from those committees to talk with these other people and just,
right,
you know, see where we stand.
Now, what about an ordinary means way of moving forward? How can a church just simply uphold union in the Christian communion just in daily worship and daily or weekly ministry?
Right. Boy, I might get in trouble with the thought I was having earlier this morning. But, I mean, you know, one way that I say that we do this, at least in the OPC, is that when we celebrate communion, which is an expression of our union with and fellowship with other believers, we don't practice closed communion. That is, we don't restrict it to either Orthodox Presbyterians or members of churches with whom we have fellowship. It is open to everyone who's baptized, who's in a member of a gospel preaching church. So, you know, we can have Baptists, Lutherans partake of the Lord's Supper when we celebrate communion. So that's a visible representation of the unity of the body of Christ. But, you know, where we fudge that is, what is a gospel preaching church?
Right.
And here's, for instance, I was thinking this morning about someone who's in the Christian Reformed Church, And so they're no longer in fellowship with the OPC, even though they were for many years. And are they in a gospel preaching church? Now, I don't want to say the CRC denies the gospel, but the reason why the OPC is no longer in fellowship with the CRC is because there are some real problems there. So should a CRC member, for instance, take communion at an Orthodox Presbyterian church? Now, the CRC member could say, well, my own congregation, my own minister is very strong, but the OPC is very much interested in the corporate witness of the church, and so it's not just about what this person's minister says, but also what the entire CRC says or what the recent synod said. Yeah. So I don't know that I have a good answer to that. The old answer used to be, and this is the Dutch Reform model, was you had to meet with the elders of the church before you took communion.
Yeah.
They had to give you the thumbs up. And since most people get to church about 5 minutes beforehand, it's pretty difficult to do that. One thing I think you could do, too, is we could actually have church, like a church passport, where you're in good standing with your particular church, and you could present this passport to a church, and then the church could stamp it. And you have to show it back to your other church when you go back home to show where you've been. I mean, you know, just any way to recognize some of the tensions and layers here.
Interesting. Well, this has been a very fascinating discussion. The history here of Presbyterian and Reformed churches and denominations, etc. I also wanted to mention the other series on Historia Ecclesia that has just concluded that Daryl has taught. An entire series on J. Gresham Machen at Calvary OPC in Glenside, Pennsylvania, of which I'm a member and of which Daryl is an elder. And that's available online. Most of them, I think all of them, have been posted at oldlife.org. But if you'd like an actual podcast feed, you can visit reformedforum.org/Historia Ecclesia. It's right there on the homepage, too, if you can't spell our Latin phrases. That was a fascinating series, and I want to thank you publicly for that, Daryl, for doing that. And we got a lot of great feedback, and it was very useful. And I'm very, very excited that we were able to record it and put that out for years to come, and for people who aren't able to come out to Glenside on a Sunday morning.
Well, I had a lot of fun. Thanks for posting that, Cam.
Yeah, and also for putting up with my wires and cables every Sunday morning trying to get your voice on tape. So thanks. And for those who would like to dive more into this, particularly Machen and what happened in the early 20th century in Presbyterianism, that's where you want to go. Visit us online at reformforum.org. You can visit Nick online at feedingonchrist.com. There, Jeff is there as well, and he has been writing of late. And, of course, Daryl Hart, oldlife.org, all sorts of interesting posts, and you can get his take on all sorts of issues there. All of our programs are online, as I said, at reformedforum.org. And please visit us on your iPhone if you have one, or an iPod Touch. Our new iPhone app is available in the App Store, and there you can listen to us anytime you want, wherever you are, provided you have service with AT&T. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to having you back next time on Christ the Center.